It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Today in your health, quitting smoking. It's not easy for anyone. We have two reports on the challenges. And we begin with NPR's Patty Naiman, who tells us that some studies show women have a harder time swearing off cigarettes than men do. Researchers are trying to understand this gender difference and develop treatments to help women get off tobacco.
31-year-old Tonya Guess describes herself as a generally optimistic person, happily married and crazy about motherhood. But there's just this one gnawing problem, cigarettes.
I want to quit very badly. I have a thousand reasons I want to quit. One, because I have a little girl, and I don't want her to become familiar with smoking. I don't want her to think that it's normal. I want her to say yuck when she smells it. I want to quit for my health. I don't want to die early, because I have a little girl and I want to see her get married and grow up.
Tonya's used nicotine replacement, both the gum and the patch, to help her quit. But even then, she says something happens, like this recent argument with her husband.
I went outside and I called my girlfriend, but the first thing I did was light up a cigarette so I can actually think. And once I had the cigarette, I felt calmer. I felt in control and just put myself in a place where I felt safe, where I felt comfortable and confident again.
Carolyn Missouri says Tonya's reaction is typical of women smokers. Missouri's a psychologist at Yale Medical School who's researching ways to help women like Tonya quit smoking. She says women's addiction to nicotine can be more complicated and more often linked to emotions than men's.
Women often report that smoking is helpful in reducing negative mood, even enhancing a positive mood, in managing the stress of daily life, and as a consequence, it often is more difficult for women to give up their cigarettes.
Psychologist Saul Schiffman from the University of Pittsburgh says government surveys of former smokers show women and men ultimately quit at about the same rate. He also says it's clear that quitting is harder for women.
The data from the federal government just counts the bodies, as it were, counts how many are ex-smokers. And that's a function not only of how successful women are, but how likely they are to try to quit, how many times they try to quit, and it includes people who haven't sought treatment. So both are accurate. They're answering different questions.
Schiffman says that when researchers look at data from clinical trials involving people who seek treatment to help them quit, like the nicotine patch or gum, for example, women are less successful in their individual quit attempts than men. Schiffman recently analyzed 12 clinical trials involving over 4,400 individuals who were trying to quit smoking. And overall, he says, women had 25% lower odds of quitting than men.
We do know that acute emotion, getting upset suddenly, can have a big role in causing people to relapse once they've quit. And there's some speculation that women might be more likely to have that kind of emotional upset.
And relapse, says Schiffman, is the name of the game. Because for most people who try to quit on their own, about 3/4 of men and women go back to smoking within just 1 week.
So essentially the key to quitting is avoiding relapse. And relapse starts with what we call a lapse, which is a specific episode when you haven't been smoking and you pick up a cigarette. And those are very likely to happen when people are emotionally upset.
Researchers around the country are working to find treatments specifically for women. At Yale University, psychologist Sherry McKee is looking at how to abstain even in the face of stress and high emotions.
So we identify one or two situations that have really stressed somebody out. We have details like what were they wearing, where were they located, who was saying what to whom, what bodily reactions they were experiencing. So people come in and describe things like arguments with spouses, job losses, so very stressful events in their life.
Then McKee and colleagues expose smokers to those scenarios and test to see if anxiety medication helps them stop lighting up. Other researchers are also evaluating talk therapies. Sherry McKee.
The idea that you can get people to have a different response when they experience these negative mood states rather than reaching for a cigarette, that they can engage in other activities that will help them improve their mood, like exercise and reaching out and getting social support from somebody, engaging in a distracting activity like going for a walk.
So between medication and therapy, researchers hope to identify which treatments help women, like Tonya Guess, quit cigarettes more easily. Patty Neiman, NPR News.
Finally this hour, we're going to remember a man who really knew how to handle a gun. NPR's Wade Goodwin tells us about a Texas sharpshooter and Western showman who passed away a few weeks ago.
Joe Bowman was so good with a single-action revolver, he could turn an aspirin into powder at 20 yards. He was so fast, he could shoot into sheet metal, the profile of an Indian in full feathered headdress. Bowman could take a playing card, set it on edge, and peel it in two with a single bullet. The performer, known as the Master of Trigonometry, could fire five times so quickly it sounded like a single, if slightly longer, shot.
Well, he'd start by what we call fanning the gun, and he would run his thumb over first, and then his index finger, and right on down his finger. Boom, 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 boom.
Tonto Rim Slim, also known as Danny Shewell, was one of the last of Bowman's friends to see him alive. Shewell says if you saw a B-Western growing up, there was a good chance you were watching an actor who'd been trained by Bowman. He trained James Arness, who played Marshal Matt Dillon in Gunsmoke, and Robert Duvall, who played Augustus McCrae in Lonesome Dove. Shewell says that after Bowman ensured these actors looked like they'd grown up with a pistol, he could put on a demonstration that would leave no doubt the studio had hired the very best tutor in the world.
You have a six-shooter in each hand and twirling them everywhere you can think of and throwing them up and catching them and back in the holster and back right out again, and that's the part I liked.
Shewell says Bowman lived the role of the chivalrous cowboy so completely it was impossible to tell where the man ended and his performing character began.
Anybody you talk to, the first thing they're going to say was that he was an unbelievable gentleman and he lived by the code. Right was right and wrong was wrong, and if he could do anything to make it right, he would.
Bowman, who looked a bit like Bob Hope, was born in Johnson City, Tennessee in 1925. As a boy, he honed his skills by shooting flies who'd had the misfortune of landing on the family barbecue grill with his BB gun. He opened a boot shop in Houston, but his hobby of performing at rodeos and fairs eventually turned into a full-time profession in the 1960s. If a measure of a man can be understood from his service to his country, Bowman can rest easy. He came home from World War II with three Bronze Stars and a Purple Heart pinned to his chest. Wade Goodwin, NPR News, Dallas.
Don't live in California? Don't really care if it sinks into the Pacific, so to speak? Well, maybe you should. Economist Ross Duvall is here now to tell us how California's crisis is affecting the rest of the country and beyond. He's director of regional economics at the Milken Institute, and that's a think tank here in Southern California. So, Mr. Duvall, if you are sitting in Houston right now or New York or anywhere else, why should you care what's happening here in California?
Well, one of the most direct effects is the national government is trying to stimulate the economy through its fiscal stimulus package, almost $800 billion. California's budget crisis is so severe that it's virtually assured that we're going to see the budget balance through expenditure cuts. And that's going to remove a lot of stimulus from the economy. And that's not only going to affect California, but it'll affect the western states. It'll affect states all across the country because Californians won't be consuming and purchasing as much as they otherwise would have been.
The federal government has refused to bail out California. And some have said, well, maybe it should because California, as you've been indicating, could be too big to fail. What do you think the federal government should do?
I think the federal government's in a very difficult position because the California delegation cannot reach an agreement as to whether or not California should get special dispensation. The Republicans in the House are very concerned about setting a precedent and expanding the federal deficit even further. And so they have been reluctant to agree to any kind of special payouts to the state of California above what was in the fiscal stimulus package. You could certainly make a case that California has a unique set of circumstances, which I agree are true to a large extent, although the state should have known better given the volatile structure of its tax system, that if you have a severe recession in California, it's going to disproportionately affect the state revenues.
And also, isn't it true that California relies much more heavily on income tax returns than other states do?
That's correct. Now, the state has a very progressive personal income tax structure, with only Hawaii having a higher marginal tax rate. And this gets to some of the heart of the issue with the budget. Capital gains and stock options realizations at the peak, right before the technology bubble burst in 2000-2001, were almost $18 billion. That fell in 2003-2004 to about $5 billion. Since the stock market took off again in 2004 through 2006, those capital gains and stock options realizations paid to the state treasury went back up to almost $17 billion. So what's happened in the state is we've become very reliant upon capital gains and stock options for our state revenues.
You talked about how California's problems are affecting the national economy in terms of putting a drag on the recovery. What about internationally? How are California's problems affecting the world economy?
Because the California economy is in such a severe recession, the demand for imports into California has fallen off quite dramatically. You could even argue that a lot of the unemployment in China, with former peasants migrating back to their villages from the factories along the coast, is partly caused by the severe recession in California, because Californians were purchasing a lot of those goods. So California is very integrated into the world economy.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That's Russ Duvall. He's Director of Regional Economics at the Milken Institute here in Southern California. And lawmakers in Sacramento are reporting progress in efforts to end this budget stalemate. Democratic leaders say they hope a resolution will come before the legislature breaks for the recess at the end of this week. The most contentious issues, though, have yet to be resolved.
If you're heading on vacation this summer, you can document the whole trip on a video camera that is small enough to fit in your pocket. We got a demonstration from Mario Armstrong, who covers technology for Morning Edition. Mario, this time you brought maybe half a dozen devices. Most of them look not much larger than a cell phone. In fact, one of them here looks more like a large cigarette lighter, old-style cigarette lighter.
Yeah, I mean, about the size of maybe a pack of cigarettes or a deck of cards. These are actual video capture devices nowadays that have become so popular because of their size and being this small.
And how much memory do they have? Can I put hours of video on one of these small things in your hand here?
Yeah, some of them, you know, range because of how they actually shoot the video or how they actually function, rather. The Flip Minnow brand, they typically have a built-in hard drive, which is done in hours. So you can shoot for 2 hours before you need to make room. But on other devices, like the Kodak ZX1 that I'm holding here, allows you to plug in a SD card, just like you do for digital cameras.
Oh,
and
okay.
So the more memory you have on your card, the more you can continue going on and shooting.
Now, this one looks a little bit more like a cell phone. It's even got a little keypad on there and so forth.
And it's more ruggedized, too. That's one thing I'll let you hold it to, and you'll probably feel a little bit of the difference between those two devices.
Oh, the Kodak is a little heftier.
A little heftier.
Throw this across the room.
Throw it across the room, a little bit weatherproof.
Do you mind if I do that now?
No, I don't mind if you do that.
Okay, well, anyway, I'll do it later.
But no, but that's some of the thing. You know, we're talking about ease of use and simplicity. So you can put them in your jeans pocket or you could put them in your purse. So they need to be a little bit more durable to be banged up. But the ZX1 has kind of taken it to another level now by being more weatherproof. So I think it's great for beach or pool activities, and or if kids want to use it and it drops, you're not worrying about it.
I understand you've taken some video with one of these devices before you came.
Yeah, let's fire that up. I shot some video on both the Kodak ZX1 and the Flip Ultra HD, and here we are.
So here we are at National Public Radio headquarters.
This is Mario talking.
And, headed on the way inside.
Doesn't sound great.
To go and see Steve Inskeep with Morning Edition. And,
you're shooting yourself. This is classic. You're going to post this on YouTube when we're done?
Possibly.
Okay, so we've got a crisp picture. Looks good in the sunlight anyway. It looks really good. I'm sure that looks great, actually, even on a wider screen. So what do we compare that to?
So we compare that to the Kodak ZX1. Let me turn that one on for you.
635 Massachusetts Avenue. I'm Mario Armstrong, and we're headed in to go see Steve Inskeep with Morning Edition. And
okay, so that's
what...
There we go. All right, that also looks pretty good. A little more film-like, actually, in terms of the color quality. So which one of these, compare and contrast these two.
You know, both of them are really, really strong. I like the Ultra HD, the Flip Minnow's ability to grab a wide shot. The ZX-1 feels a little bit more comfortable in my hand, and I like the fact that it's more ruggedized. But from a quality video perspective, both of them really seem to shoot almost on par with each other. As you mentioned, though, the ZX-1 does have that little bit of a film feel to it, which is a little bit more exciting and makes it seem like it's a little bit more quality.
So maybe the ZX-1 is what I'd go for if I wanted to be a little more of a documentary filmmaker, but if I just want something that is really easy to use, it's hard to beat this Ultra HD, which hardly has any buttons on it.
That's right.
You've brought along what I guess this is called a palm camera here. It's got a little strap that goes around and fits in your palm, and it had the screen that flips out. This looks more recognizably like a video camera, even though this is very small compared to what was available
compared to 10 years ago when you had to have something on your shoulder, leaning on your shoulder and strapped. This is a palm quarter, so you're right, it has a strap on it. It does have that flip-out screen, and you're used to seeing tourists and more families carrying those, but that's changing now. That's what this whole new shift is about. But back then, you're looking at tapes was how those devices recorded. So
these
you're holding
digital videotapes here.
That's right, a little mini DV tape. And so what the problem was, a twofold issue there. One is you had to have tapes, number one. Number two, to then share that video once it was captured, you then would have to convert that tape into some digital format, and you would have to do that in real time.
Okay, so how much does one of these new smaller video cameras cost me, video capture devices cost me, as opposed to an older palm camera?
Anywhere from $99 to about $249, still well shy of professional units that would start more around $500 or $600.
Mario Armstrong, always good when you come by.
Thanks, Steve. Pleasure being here.
He's Morning Edition's regular tech commentator and also hosts the radio show Digital Cafe on Baltimore Public Radio Station, WYPR.
Even by the standards of his own high-powered career in Congress, this is a big year for Congressman Henry Waxman. Over the years, the veteran California Democrat has battled the auto industry to keep clean air standards. He fought the drug companies to make medicines for so-called orphan diseases, ailments that afflict so few people there's less of a market for them. He got food processors to label their ingredients and baseball players to own up to their drug use. This year, the same year that he's published a memoir of those and other battles called The Waxman Report, Representative Waxman was central to House passage of an energy bill. He's chairman of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, and he is a key player in health care. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Program. Let's Pleased talk about health care a little bit. You can read a column any day now in the papers saying that a bill to overhaul the health care system is in trouble, disputes over public insurance plans, costs, raising taxes. Are you confident there's going to be a bill this year?
There's a battle going on for health care reform, but I think we're going to win that battle. There's a clear mandate by the American people when they elected Barack Obama president that they wanted him to reform the health care system. He said that's what's going to be his top legislative priority. And I'm working very closely with the administration to make it happen.
Congressman Charles Rangel, the chairman of House Ways and Means, has suggested a tax surcharge on the wealthiest American taxpayers to pay for health care reform. A good idea?
It helps pay for the health care reform, and it does it in a way that's consistent with the pledge of the president that he would not raise the taxes of people who make $250,000 a year or less. The Senate will probably come up with a different pay for, and then in the final version, we'll see where we go in the conference.
You observe at one point in your book that often a bill is decided by things that aren't evident at the beginning. Things evolve during the course of legislation. Are those things happening to healthcare right now?
Things are changing, and you never quite know where the focus of attention will end up. We started off with a lot of concern over whether there should be a public plan. And I see less concern, although we still have a lot of argument about it, less concern about the public plan and a lot more concern about how we're going to pay for this, and are we going to really hold down health care costs? All legitimate concerns, but issues that we've got to work through, because after we pass health reform, people will look back and say, how could it have been that in the United States of America, we didn't do this job earlier?
I want to ask you about something personal that happened to you. Just last week, you had a scare. You checked into the hospital. You
Yes.
were given a clean bill of health, and you came out. In that most recent brush with our healthcare system, what did you see? I mean, you're sitting on a bill that could change the way that we organize healthcare. And then you experienced care in a hospital. What do you learn?
I see that in a hospital setting, there are a lot of tests involved. in order to find out what has happened and why it happened and how to stop it from occurring again. Those tests are essential, but sometimes when you look at the broad population, they're excessive. And so what we need to do is to draw a line that balances the needs for understanding what's happening to people and not doing things that really don't offer a clear improvement in the ability of the medical profession to deal with the problem.
There's a story you relate in your book about Senator Dan Coats of Indiana and the bill to fund research on AIDS and to help patients with HIV/AIDS. And he, like a lot of conservative Republicans from a conservative state, really were quite reluctant to get involved in this. And in that case, it's the way you name a bill that frame an issue that can bring along a reluctant and critical vote.
I was surprised at the development of the legislation dealing with HIV/AIDS that we came to the point in the Senate where Senator Kennedy and Senator Hatch, who also is clearly a conservative Republican,
Orrin Hatch of Utah,
came to the conclusion that one way that helped them get this bill through was to entice Senator Coats, Dan Coats from Indiana, to join in support of the legislation by naming it the Ryan White Act. Ryan White was a young boy from Indiana who was facing enormous amount of discrimination because he was HIV positive and had AIDS, and people felt sympathetic to him. That just wasn't fair that he should be put into a situation where people thought not that he was the victim, but he was the victimizer because he had a dreaded disease. I think Senator Coats was moved by the fact that the bill was going to be named after Ryan White from his home state of Indiana.
So doing that, I mean, you know, you're going to take flack for naming the bill for, in the parlance of the day, the right kind of AIDS victim. That is, not a gay man. On the other hand, that's how you get the bill passed.
The important thing is to get legislation passed because that legislation can help so many millions of people that will need that law. And it certainly was important to get it through, and a fitting tribute to Ryan White, who suffered from the disease and brought to home to many people that AIDS did not discriminate. AIDS could affect lots of different people, and we needed to fight the disease, not the victims of the disease.
Chairman Waxman, thank you very much for talking with us today.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Congressman Henry Waxman has represented California's 30th District since the mid-1970s. His new book, written with Joshua Green, is called The Waxman Report: How Congress Really Works. It seems you can find a competition for anything. Yesterday in Chicago, fleets of librarians competed against each other, performing dance routines with their metal book carts. And Chicago Public Radio's Gabriel Spitzer had a front row seat.
Picture the stereotype of a librarian. Horn-rimmed glasses, hair in a bun, finger to lips stubbornly shushing. Now, picture the opposite of that.
What you have here are sexy black pants with a gold stripe down the side, some bedazzled Elvis tops complete with collar, cape, and cummerbund, all in a flashy LeMay gold.
Mari Bales and her Pittsburgh Steel City Kings are one of five teams at the American Library Association's annual conference for the finals. This sport is sort of like cheerleading, if cheerleaders pushed around book carts at their day jobs.
Sometimes when you're pushing them along and you have that urge to go faster or that urge to, like, spin and be flashy, well, it's exactly like when you're in the grocery store and you just want to run and hop on your buggy and kind of ride it down the aisle.
The teams have developed themes, music, costumes. Gretchen Rolchin and her teammates from Baraboo, Wisconsin, say they've cooked up some sweet moves.
Wheelies, propeller,
the daisy wheel,
the caped wonder.
Rolchin is 62 with neon blue hair, and she doesn't look the least bit out of place.
There's a stereotype that librarians are boring, and I think they want to change that stereotype to librarians are crazy.
That's Mo Willems. He and fellow children's author John Cheska are today's MCs. He says as book cart athletics get more competitive, not everyone plays clean.
Steroids.
No kidding. Doping allegations.
It is. That's been the big scandal this year.
Every one of the 600-plus seats is full. Each team rolls out its routine. The Des Plaines, Illinois cartwheels go with the Grease theme and Pink Lady and T-Bird get-ups.
The fully attached circles. I've never seen an international competition.
The librarians maneuver their carts into elaborate formations. They link up in long trains and turn intricate choreography.
Joe, what do you got?
9.2!
Oak Park, Illinois makes the day's most dramatic entrance, complete with swords, breastplates, and Viking horns.
It's building.
As the dust settles, the judges tabulate the score. It's a shocker.
We have a tie.
What?
We have a tie.
How is that possible?
Math.
Oh.
The room falls silent, awaiting a verdict from the judges.
We're going with Oak Park as number one.
The Valkyries mount their winner's gold book cart in triumph. A moving victory, even for veteran commentators Mo Willems and John Cheska.
You know what? Librarians rock. These people have actually rehearsed this.
Yeah. I honestly did get goosebumps when the Valkyries came out. It was just like, oh my God.
With the champions chosen, the MCs left the crowd with an important message. Support your local libraries and the crazy people who work there. For NPR News, I'm Gabriel Spitzer in Chicago.